the nicest action, or if no action is nicest, then take an action that is at least super-duper nice. How could there be anything objectionable about building a nice AI? But we must ask what precisely is meant by this expression. The lexicon lists various meanings of nice, but they're clearly not intended to be used here. We do not intend that the AI should be courteous and polite, nor over-delicate or fastidious. If we can count on the AI recognizing the intended interpretation of niceness, and being motivated to pursue niceness in just that sense, then this goal would seem to amount to a command to do what the programmers meant for the AI to do. An injunction to similar effect was included in the formulation of CEV, interpreted as we wish that interpreted, and in the moral permissibility criterion, as rendered earlier. Follow the intended meaning of this instruction. By affixing such a "do what I mean" clause, we may indicate that the other words in the goal description should be construed charitably rather than literally. But saying that the AI should be nice adds almost nothing. The real work is done by the "do what I mean" instruction. If we knew how to code "do what I mean" in a general and powerful way, we might as well use that as a standalone goal. How might one implement such a "do what I mean" dynamic? That is, how might we create an AI motivated to charitably interpret our wishes and unspoken intentions and to act accordingly? One initial step could be to try to get clearer about what we mean by "do what I mean." It might help if we could explicate this in more behavioristic terms. For example, in terms of revealed preferences in various hypothetical situations, such as situations in which we had more time to consider the options, in which we were smarter, in which we knew more of the relevant facts, and in which, in various other ways, conditions would be more favorable for us accurately manifesting in concrete choices what we mean when we say that we want an AI that is friendly, beneficial, nice. Here, of course, we come full circle. We have returned to the indirect normativity approach with which we started, the CEV proposal, which, in essence, expunges all concrete content from the value specification, leaving only an abstract value defined in purely procedural terms. To do that which we would have wished for the AI to do in suitably idealized circumstances. By means of such indirect normativity, we could hope to offload to the AI much of the cognitive work that we ourselves would be trying to perform if we attempted to articulate a more concrete description of what values the AI is to pursue. In seeking to take full advantage of the AI's epistemic superiority, CEV can thus be seen as an application of the principle of epistemic deference. Component list. So far, we have considered different options for what content to put into the goal system. But an AI's behavior will also be influenced by other design choices. In particular, it can make a critical difference which decision theory and which epistemology it uses. Another important question is whether the AI's plans will be subject to human review before being put into action. Table 13 summarizes these design choices. A project that aims to build a superintelligence ought to be able to explain what choices it has made regarding each of these components, and to justify why those choices were made. Goal content. We have already discussed how indirect normativity might be used in specifying the values that the AI is to pursue. We discussed some options, such as morality-based models and coherent extrapolated volition. Each such option creates further choices that need to be made. For instance, the CEV approach comes in many varieties, depending on who is included in the extrapolation base, the structure of the extrapolation, and so forth. Other forms of motivation selection methods might call for different types of goal content. For example, an oracle might be built to place a value on giving accurate answers. An oracle constructed with domesticity motivation might also have goal content that disvalues the excessive use of resources in producing its answers. Another design choice is whether to include special provisions in the goal content to reward individuals who contribute to the successful realization of the AI. For example, by giving them extra resources or influence over the AI's behavior. We can term any such provisions incentive wrapping. Incentive wrapping could be seen as a way to increase the likelihood that the project will be successful, at the cost of compromising to some extent the goal that the project set out to achieve. For example, if the project's goal is to create a dynamic that implements humanity's coherent extrapolated volition, then an incentive wrapping scheme might specify that certain individuals' volitions should be given extra weight in the extrapolation. If such a project is successful, the result is not necessarily the implementation of humanity's coherent extrapolated volition. Instead, some approximation to this goal might be achieved. Since incentive wrapping would be a piece of goal content that would be interpreted and pursued by a superintelligence, it could take advantage of indirect normativity to specify subtle and complicated provisions that would be difficult for a human manager to implement. For example, instead of rewarding programmers according to some crude but easily accessible metric, such as how many hours they worked or how many bugs they corrected, the incentive wrapping could specify that programmers are to be rewarded in proportion to how much their contributions increased some reasonable ex ante probability of the project being successfully completed in the way the sponsors intended. Further, there would be no reason to limit the incentive wrapping to project staff. It could instead specify that every person should be rewarded according to their just deserts. Credit allocation is a difficult problem, but a superintelligence could be expected to do a reasonable job of approximating the criteria specified, explicitly or implicitly, by the incentive wrapping. It is conceivable that the superintelligence might even find some way of rewarding individuals who have died prior to the superintelligence's creation. The incentive wrapping could then be extended to embrace at least some of the deceased, potentially including individuals who died before the project was conceived, or even antedating the first enunciation of the concept of incentive wrapping. Although the institution of such a retroactive policy would not causally incentivize those people who are already resting in their graves as these words are being put to the page, it might be favored for moral reasons, though it could be argued that insofar as fairness is a goal, it should be included as part of the target specification proper, rather than in the surrounding incentive wrapping. We cannot here delve into all the ethical and strategic issues associated with incentive wrapping. A project's position on these issues, however, would be an important aspect of its fundamental design concept. Decision theory. Another important design choice is which decision theory the AI should be built to use. This might affect how the AI behaves in certain strategically fateful situations. It might determine, for instance, whether the AI is open to trade with or extortion by other superintelligent civilizations whose existence it hypothesizes. The particulars of the decision theory could also matter in predicaments involving finite probabilities of infinite payoffs, Pascalian wagers, or extremely small probabilities of extremely large finite payoffs, Pascalian muggings, or in contexts where the AI is facing fundamental normative uncertainty, or where there are multiple instantiations of the same agent program. The options on the table include causal decision theory, in a variety of flavors, and evidential decision theory, along with newer candidates such as timeless decision theory and updateless decision theory, which are still under development. It may prove difficult to identify and articulate the correct decision theory, and to have justified confidence that we have got it right. Although the prospects for directly specifying an AI's decision theory are perhaps more hopeful than those of directly specifying its final values, we are still confronted with a substantial risk of error. Many of the complications that might break the currently most popular decision theories were discovered only recently, suggesting that there might exist further problems that have not yet come into sight. The result of giving the AI a flawed decision theory might be disastrous, possibly amounting to an existential catastrophe. In view of these difficulties, one might consider an indirect approach to specifying the decision theory that the AI should use. Exactly how to do this is not yet clear. We might want the AI to use that decision theory D, which we would have wanted it to use had we thought long and hard about the matter. However, the AI would need to be able to make decisions before learning what D is. It would thus need some effective interim decision theory D that would govern its search for D. One might try to define D to be some sort of superposition of the AI's current hypotheses about D, weighed by their probabilities, though there are unsolved technical problems with how to do this in a fully general way. There is also cause for concern that the AI might make irreversibly bad decisions, such as rewriting itself to henceforth run on some flawed decision theory during the learning phase, before the AI has had the opportunity to determine which particular decision theory is correct. To reduce the risk of derailment during this period of vulnerability, we might instead try to endow the seed AI with some form of restricted rationality. A deliberately simplified but hopefully dependable decision theory that staunchly ignores esoteric considerations, even ones we think may ultimately be legitimate, and that is designed to replace itself with a more sophisticated, indirectly specified decision theory once certain conditions are met. It is an open research question whether and how this could be made to work. Epistemology. A project will also need to make a fundamental design choice in selecting the AI's epistemology, specifying the principles and criteria whereby empirical hypotheses are to be evaluated. Within a Bayesian framework, we can think of the epistemology as a prior probability function, the AI's implicit assignment of probabilities to possible worlds before it has taken any perceptual evidence into account. In other frameworks, the epistemology might take a different form. But in any case, some inductive learning rule is necessary if the AI is to generalize from past observations and make predictions about the future. As with the goal content and the decision theory, however, there is a risk that our epistemology specification could miss the mark. One might think that there is a limit to how much damage could arise from an incorrectly specified epistemology. If the epistemology is too dysfunctional, then the AI could not be very intelligent, and it could not pose the kind of risk discussed in this book. But the concern is that we may specify an epistemology that is sufficiently sound to make the AI instrumentally effective in most situations, yet which has some flaw that leads the AI astray on some matter of crucial importance. Such an AI might be akin to a quick-witted person whose worldview is predicated on a false dogma, held to with absolute conviction, who consequently tilts at windmills and gives his all in pursuit of fantastical or harmful objectives. Certain kinds of subtle difference in an AI's prior could turn out to make a drastic difference to how it behaves. For example, an AI might be given a prior that assigns zero probability to the universe being infinite. No matter how much astronomical evidence it accrues to the contrary, such an AI would stubbornly reject any cosmological theory that implied an infinite universe, and it might make foolish choices as a result. Or an AI might be given a prior that assigns a zero probability to the universe not being Turing-computable. This is in fact a common feature of many of the priors discussed in the literature, including the Kolmogorov complexity prior mentioned in Chapter 1. Again, with poorly understood consequences if the embedded assumption, known as the Church-Turing thesis, should turn out to be false. An AI could also end up with a prior that make strong metaphysical commitments of one sort or another. For instance, by ruling out a priori the possibility that any strong form of mind-body dualism could be true, or the possibility that there are irreducible moral facts. If any of those commitments is mistaken, the AI might seek to realize its final goals in ways that we would regard as perverse instantiations. Yet there is no obvious reason why such an AI, despite being fundamentally wrong about one important matter, could not be sufficiently instrumentally effective to secure a decisive strategic advantage. Anthropics, the study of how to make inferences from indexical information in the presence of observation selection effects, is another area where the choice of epistemic axioms could prove pivotal. We might reasonably doubt our ability to resolve all foundational issues in epistemology in time for the construction of the first seed AI. We may, therefore, consider taking an indirect approach to specifying the AI's epistemology. This would raise many of the same issues as taking an indirect approach to specifying its decision theory. In the case of epistemology, however, there may be greater hope of benign convergence, with any of a wide class of epistemologies providing an adequate foundation for safe and effective AI and ultimately yielding similar doxastic results. The reason for this is that sufficiently abundant empirical evidence and analysis would tend to wash out any moderate differences in prior expectations. A good aim would be to endow the AI with fundamental epistemological principles that match those governing our own thinking. Any AI diverging from this ideal is an AI that we would judge to be reasoning incorrectly if we consistently applied our own standards. Of course, this applies only to our fundamental epistemological principles. Non-fundamental principles should be continuously created and revised by the seed AI itself as it develops its understanding of the world. The point of superintelligence is not to pander to human preconceptions, but to make mincemeat out of our ignorance and folly. Ratification. The final item in our list of design choices is ratification. Should the AI's plans be subjected to human review before being put into effect? For an oracle, this question is implicitly answered in the affirmative. The oracle outputs information. Human reviewers choose whether and how to act upon it. For genies, sovereigns, and tool AIs, however, the question of whether to use some form of ratification remains open. To illustrate how ratification might work, consider an AI intended to function as a sovereign implementing humanity's CEV. Instead of launching this AI directly, imagine that we first built an oracle AI for the sole purpose of answering questions about what the sovereign AI would do. As earlier chapters revealed, there are risks in creating the superintelligent oracle, such as risks of mind crime or infrastructure profusion. But for purposes of this example, let us assume that the oracle AI has been successfully implemented in a way that avoided these pitfalls. We thus have an oracle AI that offers us its best guesses about the consequences of running some piece of code intended to implement humanity's CEV. The oracle may not be able to predict in detail what would happen, but its predictions are likely to be better than our own. If it were impossible even for a superintelligence to predict anything about what the code would do, we would be crazy to run it. So the oracle ponders for a while and then presents its forecast. To make the answer intelligible, the oracle may offer the operator a range of tools with which to explore various features of the predicted outcome. The oracle could show pictures of what the future looks like and provide statistics about the number of sentient beings that will exist at different times, along with average, peak, and lowest levels of well-being. It could offer intimate biographies of several randomly selected individuals, perhaps imaginary people selected to be probably representative. It could highlight aspects of the future that the operator might not have thought of inquiring about, but which would be regarded as pertinent once pointed out. Being able to preview the outcome in this manner has obvious advantages. The preview could reveal the consequences of an error in a planned sovereign's design specifications or source code. If the crystal ball shows a ruined future, we could scrap the code for the planned sovereign AI and try something else. A strong case could be made that we should familiarize ourselves with the concrete ramifications of an option before committing to it, especially when the entire future of the race is on the line. What is perhaps less obvious is that ratification also has potentially significant disadvantages. The ironic quality of CEV might be undermined if opposing factions, instead of submitting to the arbitration of superior wisdom in confident expectation of being vindicated, could see in advance what the verdict would be. A proponent of the morality-based approach might worry that the sponsor's resolve would collapse if all the sacrifices required by the morally optimal were to be revealed. And we might all have reason to prefer a future that holds some surprises, some dissonance, some wildness, some opportunities for self-overcoming. A future whose contours are not too smugly tailored to present preconceptions, but provide some give for dramatic movement and unplanned growth. We might be less likely to take such an expansive view if we could cherry-pick every detail of the future, sending back to the drawing board any draft that does not fully conform to our fancy at that moment. The issue of sponsor ratification is therefore less clear-cut than it might initially seem. Nevertheless, on balance, it would seem prudent to take advantage of an opportunity to preview if that functionality is available. But rather than letting the reviewer fine-tune every aspect of the outcome, we might give her a simple veto, which could be exercised only a few times before the entire project would be aborted. Getting close enough. The main purpose of ratification would be to reduce the probability of catastrophic error. In general, it seems wise to aim at minimizing the risk of catastrophic error rather than at maximizing the chance of every detail being fully optimized. There are two reasons for this. First, humanity's cosmic endowment is astronomically large. There is plenty to go around, even if our process involves some waste or accepts some unnecessary constraints. Second, there is a hope that if we but get the initial conditions for the intelligence explosion approximately right, then the resulting superintelligence may eventually home in on and precisely hit our ultimate objectives. The important thing is to land in the right attractor basin. With regard to epistemology, it is plausible that a wide range of priors will ultimately converge to very similar posteriors when computed by a superintelligence and conditionalized on a realistic amount of data. We therefore need not worry about getting the epistemology exactly right. We must just avoid giving the AI a prior that is so extreme as to render the AI incapable of learning vital truths, even with the benefit of copious experience and analysis. With regard to decision theory, the risk of irrecoverable error seems larger. We might still hope to directly specify a decision theory that is good enough. A superintelligent AI could switch to a new decision theory at any time. However, if it starts out with a sufficiently wrong decision theory, it may not see the reason to switch. Even if an agent comes to see the benefits of having a different decision theory, the realization might come too late. For example, an agent designed to refuse blackmail might enjoy the benefit of deterring would-be extortionists. For this reason, blackmailable agents might do well to proactively adopt a non-exploitable decision theory. Yet once a blackmailable agent receives the threat and regards it as credible, the damage is done. Given an adequate epistemology and decision theory, we could try to design the system to implement CEV or some other indirectly specified goal content. Again, there is hope of convergence. The different ways of implementing a CEV-like dynamic would lead to the same utopian outcome. Short of such convergence, we may still hope that many of the different possible outcomes are good enough to count as existential success. It is not necessary for us to create a highly optimized design. Rather, our focus should be on creating a highly reliable design, one that can be trusted to retain enough sanity to recognize its own failings. An imperfect superintelligence, whose fundamentals are sound, would gradually repair itself, and having done so, it would exert as much beneficial optimization power on the world as if it had been perfect from the outset. Chapter 14. The Strategic Picture. It is now time to consider the challenge of superintelligence in a broader context. We would like to orient ourselves in the strategic landscape sufficiently to know at least which general direction we should be heading. This, it turns out, is not at all easy. Here in the penultimate chapter, we introduce some general analytical concepts that help us think about long-term science and technology policy issues. We then apply them to the issue of machine intelligence. It can be illuminating to make a rough distinction between two different normative stances from which a proposed policy may be evaluated. The person-affecting perspective asks whether a proposed change would be in our interest. That is to say, whether it would, on balance and in expectation, be in the interest of those morally considerable creatures who either already exist or will come into existence independently of whether the proposed change occurs or not. The impersonal perspective, in contrast, gives no special consideration to currently existing people, or to those who will come to exist independently of whether the proposed change occurs. Instead, it counts everybody equally, independently of their temporal location. The impersonal perspective sees great value in bringing new people into existence, provided they have lives worth living. The more happy lives created, the better. This distinction, although it barely hints at the moral complexities associated with a machine intelligence revolution, can be useful in a first-cut analysis. Here, we will first examine matters from the impersonal perspective. We will later see what changes if person-affecting considerations are given weight in our deliberations. Science and technology strategy. Before we zoom in on issues specific to machine superintelligence, we must introduce some strategic concepts and considerations that pertain to scientific and technological development more generally. Differential technological development. Suppose that a policymaker proposes to cut funding for a certain research field out of concern for the risks or long-term consequences of some hypothetical technology that might eventually grow from its soil. She can then expect a howl of opposition from the research community. Scientists and their public advocates often say that it is futile to try to control the evolution of technology by blocking research. If some technology is feasible, the argument goes, it will be developed regardless of any particular policymaker's scruples about speculative future risks. Indeed, the more powerful the capabilities that a line of development promises to produce, the surer we can be that somebody, somewhere, will be motivated to pursue it. Funding cuts will not stop progress or forestall its concomitant dangers. Interestingly, this futility objection is almost never raised when a policymaker proposes to increase funding to some area of research, even though the argument would seem to cut both ways. One rarely hears indignant voices protest, "Please do not increase our funding. Rather, make some cuts. Researchers in other countries will surely pick up the slack. The same work will get done anyway. Don't squander the public's treasure on domestic scientific research." What accounts for this apparent doublethink? One plausible explanation, of course, is that members of the research community have a self-serving bias which leads us to believe that research is always good and tempts us to embrace almost any argument that supports our demand for more funding. However, it is also possible that the double standard can be justified in terms of national self-interest. Suppose that the development of a technology has two effects, giving a small benefit B to its inventors and the country that sponsors them, while imposing an aggregately larger harm, H, which could be a risk externality, on everybody. Even somebody who is largely altruistic might then choose to develop the overall harmful technology. They might reason that the harm H will result no matter what they do, since if they refrain, somebody else will develop the technology anyway. And given that total welfare cannot be affected, they might as well grab the benefit B for themselves and their nation. Unfortunately, there will soon be a device that will destroy the world. Fortunately, we got the grant to build it. Whatever the explanation for the futility objection's appeal, it fails to show that there is, in general, no impersonal reason for trying to steer technological development. It fails, even if we concede the motivating idea that with continued scientific and technological development efforts, all relevant technologies will eventually be developed. That is, even if we concede the following. Technological completion conjecture. If scientific and technological development efforts do not effectively cease, then all important basic capabilities that could be obtained through some possible technology will be obtained. There are at least two reasons why the technological completion conjecture does not imply the futility objection. First, the antecedent might not hold, because it is not in fact a given that scientific and technological development efforts will not effectively cease before the attainment of technological maturity. This reservation is especially pertinent in a context that involves existential risk. Second, even if we could be certain that all important basic capabilities that could be obtained through some possible technology will be obtained, it could still make sense to attempt to influence the direction of technological research. What matters is not only whether a technology is developed, but also when it is developed, by whom, and in what context. These circumstances of birth of a new technology, which shape its impact, can be affected by turning funding spigots on or off, and by wielding other policy instruments. These reflections suggest a principle that would have us attend to the relative speed with which different technologies are developed. The principle of differential technological development. Retard the development of dangerous and harmful technologies, especially ones that raise the level of existential risk, and accelerate the development of beneficial technologies, especially those that reduce the existential risks posed by nature or by other technologies. A policy could thus be evaluated on the basis of how much of a differential advantage it gives to desired forms of technological development over undesired forms. Preferred order of arrival. Some technologies have an ambivalent effect on existential risks, increasing some existential risks while decreasing others. Superintelligence is one such technology. We have seen in earlier chapters that the introduction of machine superintelligence would create a substantial existential risk, but it would reduce many other existential risks. Risks from nature, such as asteroid impacts, supervolcanoes, and natural pandemics, would be virtually eliminated, since superintelligence could deploy countermeasures against most such hazards, or at least demote them to the non-existential category, for instance via space colonization. These existential risks from nature are comparatively small over the relevant timescales. But superintelligence would also eliminate or reduce many anthropogenic risks. In particular, it would reduce risks of accidental destruction, including risk of accidents related to new technologies. Being generally more capable than humans, a superintelligence would be less likely to make mistakes, and more likely to recognize when precautions are needed, and to implement precautions competently. A well-constructed superintelligence might sometimes take a risk, but only when doing so is wise. Furthermore, at least in scenarios where the superintelligence forms a singleton, many non-accidental anthropogenic existential risks deriving from global coordination problems would be eliminated. These include risks of wars, technology races, undesirable forms of competition and evolution, and tragedies of the commons. Since substantial peril would be associated with human beings developing synthetic biology, molecular nanotechnology, climate engineering, instruments for biomedical enhancement and neuropsychological manipulation, tools for social control that may facilitate totalitarianism or tyranny, and other technologies as yet unimagined, eliminating these types of risk would be a great boon. An argument could therefore be mounted that earlier arrival dates of superintelligence are preferable. However, if risks from nature and from other hazards unrelated to future technology are small, then this argument could be refined. What matters is that we get superintelligence before other dangerous technologies, such as advanced nanotechnology. Whether it happens sooner or later may not be so important from an impersonal perspective, so long as the order of arrival is right. The ground for preferring superintelligence to come before other potentially dangerous technologies, such as nanotechnology, is that superintelligence would reduce the existential risks from nanotechnology, but not vice versa. Hence, if we create superintelligence first, we will face only those existential risks that are associated with superintelligence. Whereas if we create nanotechnology first, we will face the risks of nanotechnology, and then, additionally, the risks of superintelligence. Even if the existential risks from superintelligence are very large, and even if superintelligence is the riskiest of all technologies, there could thus be a case for hastening its arrival. These sooner is better arguments, however, presuppose that the riskiness of creating superintelligence is the same, regardless of when it is created. If, instead, its riskiness declines over time, it might be better to delay the machine intelligence revolution. While a later arrival would leave more time for other existential catastrophes to intercede, it could still be preferable to slow the development of superintelligence. This would be especially plausible if the existential risks associated with superintelligence are much larger than those associated with other disruptive technologies. There are several quite strong reasons to believe that the riskiness of an intelligence explosion will decline significantly over a multi-decadal time frame. One reason is that a later date leaves more time for the development of solutions to the control problem. The control problem has only recently been recognized, and most of the current best ideas for how to approach it were discovered only within the past decade or so, and in several cases during the time that this book was being written. It is plausible that the state of the art will advance greatly over the next several decades, and if the problem turns out to be very difficult, a significant rate of progress might continue for a century or more. The longer it takes for superintelligence to arrive, the more such progress will have been made when it does. This is an important consideration in favor of later arrival dates, and a very strong consideration against extremely early arrival dates. Another reason why superintelligence later might be safer is that this would allow more time for various beneficial background trends of human civilization to play themselves out. How much weight one attaches to this consideration will depend on how optimistic one is about these trends. An optimist could certainly point to a number of encouraging indicators and hopeful possibilities. People might learn to get along better, leading to reductions in violence, war, and cruelty. And global coordination and the scope of political integration might increase, making it easier to escape undesirable technology races, more on this below, and to work out an arrangement whereby the hoped-for gains from an intelligence explosion would be widely shared. There appear to be long-term historical trends in these directions. Further, an optimist could expect that the sanity level of humanity will rise over the course of this century, that prejudices will, on balance, recede, that insights will accumulate, and that people will become more accustomed to thinking about abstract future probabilities and global risks. With luck, we could see a general uplift of epistemic standards in both individual and collective cognition. Again, there are trends pushing in these directions. Scientific progress means that more will be known. Economic growth may give a greater portion of the world's population adequate nutrition, particularly during the early years of life that are important for brain development, and access to quality education. Advances in information technology will make it easier to find, integrate, evaluate, and communicate data and ideas. Furthermore, by the century's end, humanity will have made an additional 100 years worth of mistakes, from which something might have been learned. Many potential developments are ambivalent in the above-mentioned sense, increasing some existential risks and decreasing others. For example, advances in surveillance, data mining, lie detection, biometrics, and psychological or neurochemical means of manipulating beliefs and desires could reduce some existential risks by making it easier to coordinate internationally or to suppress terrorists and renegades at home. These same advances, however, might also increase some existential risks by amplifying undesirable social dynamics or by enabling the formation of permanently stable totalitarian regimes. One important frontier is the enhancement of biological cognition, such as through genetic selection. When we discussed this in chapters 2 and 3, we concluded that the most radical forms of superintelligence would be more likely to arise in the form of machine intelligence. That claim is consistent with cognitive enhancement playing an important role in the lead-up to and creation of machine superintelligence. Cognitive enhancement might seem obviously risk-reducing. The smarter the people working on the control problem, the more likely they are to find a solution. However, cognitive enhancement could also hasten the development of machine intelligence, thus reducing the time available to work on the problem. Cognitive enhancement would also have many other relevant consequences. These issues deserve a closer look. Most of the following remarks about cognitive enhancement apply equally to non-biological means of increasing our individual or collective epistemic effectiveness. Rates of change and cognitive enhancement. An increase in either the mean or the upper range of human intellectual ability would likely accelerate technological progress across the board, including progress toward various forms of machine intelligence, progress on the control problem, and progress on a wide swathe of other technical and economic objectives. What would be the net effect of such acceleration? Consider the limiting case of a universal accelerator, an imaginary intervention that accelerates literally everything. The action of such a universal accelerator would correspond merely to an arbitrary rescaling of the time metric, producing no qualitative change in observed outcomes. If we are to make sense of the idea that cognitive enhancement might generally speed things up, we clearly need some other concept than that of universal acceleration. A more promising approach is to focus on how cognitive enhancement might increase the rate of change in one type of process relative to the rate of change in some other type of process. Such differential acceleration could affect a system's dynamics. Thus, consider the following concept. Macrostructural development accelerator. A lever that accelerates the rate at which macrostructural features of the human condition develop, while leaving unchanged the rate at which micro-level human affairs unfold. Imagine pulling this lever in the decelerating direction. The brake pad is lowered onto the great wheel of world history. Sparks fly, and metal screeches. After the wheel has settled into a more leisurely pace, the result is a world in which technological innovation occurs more slowly, and in which fundamental or globally significant change in political structure and culture happens less frequently and less abruptly. A greater number of generations come and go before one era gives way to another. During the course of a lifespan, a person sees little change in the basic structure of the human condition. For most of our species' existence, macrostructural development was slower than it is now. 50,000 years ago, an entire millennium might have elapsed without a single significant technological invention, without any noticeable increase in human knowledge and understanding, and without any globally meaningful political change. On a micro level, however, the kaleidoscope of human affairs churned at a reasonable rate, with births, deaths, and other personally and locally significant events. The average person's day might have been more action-packed in the Pleistocene than it is today. If you came upon a magic lever that would let you change the rate of macrostructural development, what should you do? Ought you to accelerate, decelerate, or leave things as they are? Assuming the impersonal standpoint, this question requires us to consider the effects on existential risk. Let us distinguish between two kinds of risk: state risks and step risks. A state risk is one that is associated with being in a certain state, and the total amount of state risk to which a system is exposed is a direct function of how long the system remains in that state. Risks from nature are typically state risks. The longer we remain exposed, the greater the chance that we will get struck by an asteroid, supervolcanic eruption, gamma ray burst, naturally arising pandemic, or some other slash of the cosmic scythe. Some anthropogenic risks are also state risks. At the level of an individual, the longer a soldier pokes his head up above the parapet, the greater the cumulative chance he will be shot by an enemy sniper. There are anthropogenic state risks at the existential level as well. The longer we live in an internationally anarchic system, the greater the cumulative chance of a thermonuclear Armageddon or of a great war fought with other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, laying waste to civilization. A step risk, by contrast, is a discrete risk associated with some necessary or desirable transition. Once the transition is completed, the risk vanishes. The amount of step risk associated with the transition is usually not a simple function of how long the transition takes. One does not halve the risk of traversing a minefield by running twice as fast. Conditional on a fast takeoff, the creation of superintelligence might be a step risk. There would be a certain risk associated with the takeoff, the magnitude of which would depend on what preparations had been made. But the amount of risk might not depend much on whether the takeoff takes 20 milliseconds or 20 hours. We can then say the following regarding a hypothetical macrostructural development accelerator. Insofar as we are concerned with existential state risks, we should favor acceleration, provided we think we have a realistic prospect of making it through to a post-transition era in which any further existential risks are greatly reduced. If it were known that there is some step ahead destined to cause an existential catastrophe, then we ought to reduce the rate of macrostructural development, or even put it in reverse, in order to give more generations a chance to exist before the curtain is rung down. But in fact, it would be overly pessimistic to be so confident that humanity is doomed. At present, the level of existential state risk appears to be relatively low. If we imagine the technological macro conditions for humanity frozen in their current state, it seems very unlikely that an existential catastrophe would occur on a timescale of, say, a decade. So a delay of one decade, provided it occurred at our current stage of development, or at some other time when state risk is low, would incur only a very minor existential state risk. Whereas a postponement by one decade of subsequent technological developments might well have a significant beneficial impact on later existential step risks, for example, by allowing more time for preparation. Upshot. The main way that the speed of macrostructural development is important is by affecting how well prepared humanity is when the time comes to confront the key step risks. So the question we must ask is how cognitive enhancement and concomitant acceleration of macrostructural development would affect the expected level of preparedness at the critical juncture. Should we prefer a shorter period of preparation with higher intelligence? With higher intelligence, the preparation time could be used more effectively, and the final critical step would be taken by a more intelligent humanity. Or should we prefer to operate with closer to current levels of intelligence, if that gives us more time to prepare? Which option is better depends on the nature of the challenge being prepared for. If the challenge were to solve a problem for which learning from experience is key, then the chronological length of the preparation period might be the determining factor, since time is needed for the requisite experience to accumulate. What would such a challenge look like? One hypothetical example would be a new weapons technology that we could predict would be developed at some point in the future, and that would make it the case that any subsequent war would have, let us say, a 1 in 10 chance of causing an existential catastrophe. If such were the nature of the challenge facing us, then we might wish the rate of macrostructural development to be slow, so that our species would have more time to get its act together before the critical step when the new weapons technology is invented. One could hope that during the grace period secured through the deceleration, our species might learn to avoid war, that international relations around the globe might come to resemble those between the countries of the European Union, which, having fought one another ferociously for centuries, now coexist in peace and relative harmony. The pacification might occur as a result of the gentle edification from various civilizing processes, or through the shock therapy of sub-existential blows, e.g., small nuclear conflagrations, and the recoil and resolve they might engender to finally create the global institutions necessary for the abolishment of interstate wars. If this kind of learning or adjusting would not be much accelerated by increased intelligence, then cognitive enhancement would be undesirable, serving merely to burn the fuse faster. A prospective intelligence explosion, however, may present a challenge of a different kind. The control problem calls for foresight, reasoning, and theoretical insight. It is less clear how increased historical experience would help. Direct experience of the intelligence explosion is not possible until too late, and many features conspire to make the control problem unique and lacking in relevant historical precedent. For these reasons, the amount of time that will elapse before the intelligence explosion may not matter much per se. Perhaps what matters instead is A, the amount of intellectual progress on the control problem achieved by the time of the detonation, and B, the amount of skill and intelligence available at the time to implement the best available solutions, and to improvise what is missing. That this latter factor should respond positively to cognitive enhancement is obvious. How cognitive enhancement would affect factor A is a somewhat subtler matter. Suppose, as suggested earlier, that cognitive enhancement would be a general macrostructural development accelerator. This would hasten the arrival of the intelligence explosion, thus reducing the amount of time available for preparation and for making progress on the control problem. Normally, this would be a bad thing. However, if the only reason why there is less time available for intellectual progress is that intellectual progress is speeded up, then there need be no net reduction in the amount of intellectual progress that will have taken place by the time the intelligence explosion occurs. At this point, cognitive enhancement might appear to be neutral with respect to factor A. The same intellectual progress that would otherwise have been made prior to the intelligence explosion, including progress on the control problem, still gets made, only compressed within a shorter time interval. In actuality, however, cognitive enhancement may well prove a positive influence on A. One reason why cognitive enhancement might cause more progress to have been made on the control problem by the time the intelligence explosion occurs, is that progress on the control problem may be especially contingent on extreme levels of intellectual performance, even more so than the kind of work necessary to create machine intelligence. The role for trial and error and accumulation of experimental results seems quite limited in relation to the control problem, whereas experimental learning will probably play a large role in the development of artificial intelligence or whole brain emulation. The extent to which time can substitute for wit may therefore vary between tasks in a way that should make cognitive enhancement promote progress on the control problem more than it would promote progress on the problem of how to create machine intelligence. Another reason why cognitive enhancement should differentially promote progress on the control problem is that the very need for such progress is more likely to be appreciated by cognitively more capable societies and individuals. It requires foresight and reasoning to realize why the control problem is important and to make it a priority. It may also require uncommon sagacity to find promising ways of approaching such an unfamiliar problem. From these reflections, we might tentatively conclude that cognitive enhancement is desirable, at least insofar as the focus is on the existential risks of an intelligence explosion. Parallel lines of thinking apply to other existential risks arising from challenges that require foresight and reliable abstract reasoning, as opposed to, e.g., incremental adaptation to experienced changes in the environment, or a multi-generational process of cultural maturation and institution building. Technology couplings. Suppose that one thinks that solving the control problem for artificial intelligence is very difficult, that solving it for whole brain emulations is much easier, and that it would therefore be preferable that machine intelligence be reached via the whole brain emulation path. We will return later to the question of whether whole brain emulation would be safer than artificial intelligence. But for now, we want to make the point that even if we accept this premise, it would not follow that we ought to promote whole brain emulation technology. One reason, discussed earlier, is that a later arrival of superintelligence may be preferable in order to allow more time for progress on the control problem and for other favorable background trends to culminate. And thus, if one were confident that whole brain emulation would precede AI anyway, it would be counterproductive to further hasten the arrival of whole brain emulation. But even if it were the case that it would be best for whole brain emulation to arrive as soon as possible, it still would not follow that we ought to favor progress toward whole brain emulation. For it is possible that progress toward whole brain emulation will not yield whole brain emulation. It may instead yield neuromorphic artificial intelligence, forms of AI that mimic some aspects of cortical organization, but do not replicate neuronal functionality with sufficient fidelity to constitute a proper emulation. If, as there is reason to believe, such neuromorphic AI is worse than the kind of AI that would otherwise have been built, and if by promoting whole brain emulation we would make neuromorphic AI arrive first, then our pursuit of the supposed best outcome, whole brain emulation, would lead to the worst outcome, neuromorphic AI. Whereas, if we had pursued the second best outcome, synthetic AI, we might actually have attained the second best, synthetic AI. We have just described an hypothetical instance of what we might term a technology coupling. This refers to a condition in which two technologies have a predictable timing relationship, such that developing one of the technologies has a robust tendency to lead to the development of the other, either as a necessary precursor or as an obvious and irresistible application or subsequent step. Technology couplings must be taken into account when we use the principle of differential technological development. It is no good accelerating the development of a desirable technology Y if the only way of getting Y is by developing an extremely undesirable precursor technology X, or if getting Y would immediately produce an extremely undesirable related technology, Z. Before you marry your sweetheart, consider the prospective in-laws. In the case of whole-brain emulation, the degree of technology coupling is debatable. We noted in Chapter 2 that while whole-brain emulation would require massive progress in various